Medicaid expansion, saving the Brazilian rainforest, and a new art exhibit lights up Coral Gables. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. The pandemic has made it abundantly clear that a lot of Floridians don't have enough health care coverage. Democrats in the state legislature are pushing for Medicaid expansion. This time, they're looking for a referendum to take to the voters. We'll get the details. Also, the Amazon rainforest is disappearing at an alarming rate, and that will impact the health of the planet and all of us. What efforts can the Biden administration take to preserve this precious global resource? And finally, not all art needs to be appreciated in a museum. There's an outdoor public art show going on now in Coral Gables that's lighting up the night sky. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us today. Well, next week, the Florida legislature convenes with a number of daunting challenges. A record loss of life, an economy struggling to recover from the tourism dive, and social justice issues all remain top of mind. Democratic State Senator Perry Thurston has proposals for Medicaid expansion. He also wants to expand access to medical marijuana. Let's talk to him now. State Senator Perry Thurston joins us. Senator, I appreciate the time. Thank you so much.
Hello, and Louis, good to be here, and always a pleasure.
I definitely appreciate it. There's so much to tackle. Let me start with this. I want to look at how the state has handled the pandemic. And we have a new administration in the White House, but I wonder, what have you seen in the way a Republican governor has handled the changes brought on by President Biden?
Well, I think there was an initial sort of putting up of the guard, not wanting to address some of the issues that here comes a new leader and not wanting to accept all that was going to be sent down. But I'm happy to see that. I think he's sort of reversed his position, and now he's going to accept all the funds that are coming in from FEMA and the help. You know, that's what our national government does, and they do a very good job at it. So I think we're going to see an opening, welcoming of the assistance.
You know, I mean, besides this these storms that we've seen, the weather that's slowed down so much of the country that we may see a delay in the transfer of these vaccines to Florida. But besides that, though, I'm just wondering what you're hearing from folks in your district about the challenges they face. What's frustrating them most about getting the vaccine?
Well, I think what's frustrating the most, Louis, if you think about it, when the governor first jumped out there and he promises 65 and older will get the vaccine, and then knowing that we didn't have access based on supply and demand, and all that did was force people to run around and call different offices trying to see how can we get it when we didn't have the resources to make those type of promises. So you created a hysteria that didn't need to be created. And quite frankly, from the communities that I represent, it was a second coming. Initially, we were not included on the testing sites. And eventually we did get testing sites in our community, which we were very thankful for, but never on the first round when we would see the governor going to the villages and the Century Villages and Kings Point and all the other facilities, some of which I represent. Well, a lot of the people in our community are 65 years and older, live in multi-generational homes with their children. So that's where we needed to have the second phase with the churches, where individuals in single family homes can bring their loved ones to a place where they felt comfortable.
Like I wanted the church community. There's a couple things here about this I wanted to ask you, because we saw during the height of the pandemic that the Black community was getting hit harder than the white community by this virus. And now we see the Black community still lagging behind in getting their vaccines proportionally to the white community. And I'm wondering, you know, is it again access, or how much of it is just maybe perhaps distrust in the system?
Well, when you say distrust, there is some distrust based on historically significant acts of the government when it comes down to the African-American community. But what I found, Lewis, is that most of the community that I represent are willing to get the vaccine. They're just not being offered the vaccine.
Yeah.
We have a more of a distrust, not so much distrust, just availability.
I see.
And I think that when you hear the federal government talk about equitable distribution, well, they're talking about getting the vaccine to those individuals who are high risk, getting the vaccine to those who have been disproportionately affected, those who have had to be hospitalized more. Those are the communities, those are the Black and brown communities that we should focus on because they're hardest hit with this pandemic.
Yeah. One of the things we saw recently here in Miami especially was some of the Hispanic communities, church leaders who were spreading conspiracy theories about the vaccine. What are they saying in Black churches about the vaccine?
Fortunately, I think that by using the churches to facilitate it, we're really not getting that type of misleading leadership. We're getting our ministers and the leaders in our community on the forefront, not only taking the test, but facilitating not only taking the vaccine, but facilitating their parishioners to get the vaccine, and not just their parishioners. Individuals in their communities around their churches are all going to the churches, and I tell you, they're having the best experience. They're not having the long lines and the wait, and it's not just the Black community. I see a lot of a majority community coming to the churches and being served as well.
Yeah, this leads to the question of Medicaid. Democrats want to expand Medicaid in Florida. You've got a bill on this, but first I want to ask about this push to bring it to a referendum to the voters. Explain that to me, please.
Well, I think that one of my colleagues, I believe it's Senator Tadeo, has a bill that's asking that to let the communities vote. You know, there's only, I believe, 14 states who have not accepted the expansion of Medicaid. You know, quite frankly, we could not have predicted when we asked the legislature to accept the initial offering of over $50 billion coming from the federal government. We talked about the fact that if you don't accept this money, you're going to have deaths. People who would get the type of preventive care that they need will not receive it, and therefore they're going to have bad outcomes. And some of those outcomes are going to lead to fatalities. At that time, we didn't know that this pandemic was looming and that it would come and hit us like a thunderstorm. Well, those predictions have not only come true, they're like on steroids, because our communities are suffering. With that assistance, we could have had people who would have had much better outcomes.
Yeah.
And to not accept those monies when they came down was one of the worst things that our state government and the leaders of Florida could have ever done.
And that goes back to Governor Rick Scott under the Obama administration, again, not accepting the Medicaid funds. You have a bill to expand Medicaid to those who don't qualify under the current system. How many people would that help?
It would help over 700,000 people right away. And what we see, Lewis, is that we're in a state right now where those type of medical assistance is desperately needed. But not only that, we've got a budget with a lot of holes that need to be filled. Those funds would help Florida in so many ways. But if we just get away from the monetary aspect and just think about saving lives, think about the the outcomes that we've talked about in the black and brown communities that would be so much better had we accepted the Affordable Care Act. But even now, if we just expand Medicaid the way this bill is asking, you're going to see benefits for neighbors and Floridians all across the state.
You know what, though? I mean, I understand what you're saying about, you know, with money and lives and not, you know, putting, you know, the two together. But here's the reality. You have Republicans in charge of the legislature, you know. So have you heard of any Republican who is going to be on board with this? You're going to get a lot of pushback. You know that.
Well, you're absolutely right. We expect to get pushback, but that's why it's incumbent upon all Floridians, not just the elected members of the Florida legislature. And that's why Representative Tadeo is asking that it be put on the ballot. You know, Louis, a lot of things that we need to accomplish here in the state of Florida, we accomplish it through citizens initiatives. And that's because you've got a legislature that, quite frankly, are not always listening to the people. When you look at class size amendment, you look at restoration of rights, you look at fair districts, all of these things that are needed and wanted by the citizens of Florida didn't come from the sponsoring of legislation by the Speaker of the House or the Senate President. It came from real Americans who see the need, who see that their family members are suffering from lack of sufficient medical care. And that's why we want to put it on the ballot, to ask the people to support it. And in the meantime, we want people to talk about it. Shows like yours, talking to listeners who see what's going on and asking, well, why isn't this bill being heard? You know, a lot of times when I go places, Louis, people ask me and they say, well, you know, it's a no-brainer that this should be done. Why isn't it being done? Why didn't somebody propose a bill to address this issue? And all I can tell them is we have proposed a bill. They're just not putting it on the agenda. But the bills are out there, and I think they're leadership needs to hear the bills.
Again, I'm talking with Democratic State Senator Perry Thurston of Broward County. The Florida legislature set to convene next week. Issues like COVID relief, the economy, social justice, and so much more that will be discussed. Again, you can find more of the coverage of this year's session. Go to our social media at WLRN Sundial. I wanted to get to medical marijuana. You have two bills on this. You have one that prohibits retailers from producing their own product. Where do you see the greatest issue with the current system of production right now?
Well, when I talk to my community, Louis, everyone says, well, you know, it seems so ironic that a community that suffered so much from the criminalization of marijuana are benefiting so least from the legalization. And it's shocking because when you have the seminars and you're told that Florida has voted for this vertical integration as a means of producing medical marijuana and possibly when it becomes recreational marijuana, it's designed not to allow regular individuals to participate at all. So what one of my bills do is it says, well, allow... instead of your vertical integration, at least allow from a retail perspective others to participate in the process. And that comes directly from various meetings in the committee, in the community about marijuana. When they were asked, well, how do I participate? There are people who have means who want to participate, but they don't necessarily have the means of some of the companies who've jumped out here and taken advantage of those opportunities. And if you look at it, Louis, right now, they have such a great advantage based on their awarding those licenses. It'll be hard for anyone to ever catch up. But that doesn't mean that we shouldn't share the wealth.
You talk about those licenses. What about black farmers growing medical marijuana? To what extent do those folks have access?
Well, Louis, there was one license designated to black farmers, and that has been held up in litigation. But we, as a caucus, will be pushing to make sure that is accomplished. That license is granted to one of the black farmers who are on the designated list. It's unfortunate that that hasn't been done already.
The other thing too, I wanted to talk about the other bill you have is about the Office of Medical Marijuana Uses. You want them to impose more fees, right? Because that's more money for the state.
Well, if you look at our budget right now, Lewis, you see we have a projected $2.7 billion deficit. There are a number of things that we can do to increase that. This is one of them. Expansion of gaming is another thing that we can do. That Seminole Compact can be addressed as well. We're proposing things that we think are just no-brainers, things that can help our state get out of this hole without cutting education and health care. And so when we're looking, all the great ideas or the good ideas for the state of Florida doesn't come from one side of the aisle, Lewis. And what we need to have is we need to have honest discussions and serious discussions about how we increase revenue. And quite frankly, that is one of the ways we could.
All right, let me finish with this because you just said it. Not all ideas, all the good ideas come from one side. That's true, but one side is in control. What do you see as the biggest challenge for this legislative session for you?
Well, for me, the biggest side, the biggest challenge is this. We did not convene a special session during the summer months when we should have, when the COVID was ravishing our communities. So now there's so many things that we're trying to get accomplished in such a short period of time. And the leadership is focused on things like protecting businesses. Limiting liabilities of businesses, as opposed to focusing on the needs of the community. People are still suffering with food insecurities. We're getting ready to have massive tenant evictions and not just tenant evictions, but foreclosures. Individuals are hurting, and instead of looking at protecting them, we're looking at protecting the businesses, not allowing people to even receive workers' compensation for injuries that they may have sustained on the at their job. The focus is totally in the wrong place while Floridians are suffering and hurting.
Well, as I said, you folks have a lot to talk about in this upcoming session, folks being you lawmakers. So I'm going to wish you the best. Again, Democratic State Senator Perry Thurston of Broward County joining us. Senator, thanks as always. I really appreciate the time.
Thank you, Lewis.
All right, still to come. The Amazon rainforest is shrinking at an alarming rate. Will the Biden administration take action? Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. 2020 was a devastating year for humans across the globe. It was also devastating for the environment. A report from the Amazon Conservation Association using satellite imagery found the rainforest lost 5 million acres due to fires, logging, and development. The rainforest plays an essential role as a global beacon for oxygen, a biodiverse resource unlike anything else anywhere. It's also critical for the South American economy, and it's home to 400 indigenous tribes. A coalition of former U.S. cabinet officials and climate policy experts see the Biden administration as a reason for hope and are calling for direct action. Dr. Monica DeBoll is an author and senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. She's also an adjunct lecturer and former director for Latin American Studies and Emerging Markets at the School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University. And she joins us now. Dr. DeBoll, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
So much of the reporting throughout this pandemic explored how the mandatory shutdowns were actually having a positive impact on the environment. I mean, we saw improvements in air and water quality around the world, but why was deforestation still so prolific in 2020?
So that has been an ongoing problem in Brazil specifically, but in other parts of Latin America where the Amazon rainforest spreads to. Every year during the sort of dry season, if you can call it that, because it's a rainforest, so the dry season isn't quite that dry. But every year during the dry season, there's a lot of incursions by illegal loggers and cattle growers and just another agents that basically make these incursions into the rainforest to expand their land holdings. And that has happened, you know, for several years. There was an attempt some years back to try to hold back on these illegal activities that was pretty successful. But since the current Brazilian administration took charge in 2019, we have seen a very high uptick, not quite an uptick, actually an increase, very high increase in deforestation in the Amazon.
You know what? You just said something interesting, illegal activity. And you know what? Is the Brazilian government, it appears that they're tactically supporting that. Or
yes,
am I just, okay, all right, just to make sure.
Yeah, they are. They are supporting it in various ways. They're supporting it in very indirect ways in having dismantled the agencies that were responsible for environmental protection and the monitoring and supervision and enforcement of environmental legislation. So these have basically suffered from underfunding, and a lot of good people have left because of pressure from the Bolsonaro administration. But then in addition to that, the rhetoric has also been one of, we need to develop the Amazon and you can just go in and basically do whatever you want. And that's exactly what's been happening.
How important, and I mentioned earlier the number of indigenous communities that live there, but how important have they been to protecting the rainforest, or can they? All right, Dr. DeBole, do I still have you there?
Hello?
Yes, hi. Are you still there? Can you hear me? All right, we're having a little technical issue in the connection. I know that she is there. See if she can hear me at any point. Again, just to mention, we are talking with Dr. Monica DeBole. She is a professor of economics at Johns Hopkins University, specializing in Latin American studies. And we are exploring the issue of deforestation in the Amazon rainforest. And, of course, the actions the Biden administration could take to further protect it. All right, let's see if she's there. Dr. DeBole, I'm sorry, are you there?
I'm here, yes.
All right, sorry about that issue there. I wanted to come back real quickly. I was asking you about the indigenous communities, as I mentioned before, and I'm wondering, what role do they play in protecting the rainforest, or can they?
Well, they're very organized, and they've been active in trying to protect, you know, the environment in which they live and which is very much responsible for their subsistence. But there's currently a big problem. The pandemic has hit the areas where the Amazon area is located very, very hard. So the northern states of Brazil, and the Amazon rainforest comprises about 60% of the Brazilian territory coming from the north. Those happen to be also the poorest states and where health services are not great. But in addition, novel viral variants, these variants of concern, one of them has actually shown up in Manaus, which is a city in the state of Amazonas at the heart of the Brazilian Amazon. And it has been devastating and has had devastating consequences for the population at large, but for indigenous communities in particular. So these indigenous communities are suffering very much from the pandemic. And as a result, they have not had the chance to organize in the same way that they have in the past to push back on deforestation. And that has been particularly dramatic and tragic in 2020.
You know, I remember going back to my childhood in the 80s, and I remember how I heard about the need to protect the rainforest and how important it is. And I mean, celebrities got involved. It was, you know, I mean, this has been going on for a while. And I think, though, that even as we've been hearing the message for a long time, it's important to remember that the rainforest plays a very big role on the issue of climate change. Remind us how much.
Well, it's huge. It's huge because usually we read about the Amazon rainforest and we sort of think, oh, it's the lungs of the world. But actually, what the rainforest really does is once you have, as long as you have trees standing, what those trees are actually doing is that they're, or the vegetation, is that it's actually maintaining a lot of carbon underground. So the moment you start cutting down trees and deforesting, what you're doing is you're releasing massive amounts of carbon into the atmosphere. So I like to refer to the Amazon less as the lungs of the world and more as the sort of standing issue that prevents us from having a carbon bomb going off into the atmosphere, because yeah, that is what the rainforest does.
You're Brazilian.
Yes.
I'm curious, like, how were you taught? What were you taught growing up? Because again, I just remember the conversations, and I'd see this on television all the time growing up. You know, we got to protect the rainforest, got to protect the rainforest. And again, celebrities putting on concerts to raise money to protect the rainforest. What did you grow up hearing, and what were you taught about it?
Well, I was taught that it was important to preserve it precisely because it had, you know, this lungs of the world aspect. So not really much of an incursion into what does that mean, you know. And in practice, what it means is the rainforest does not allow all of this carbon, underground carbon, to be released into the atmosphere. That's one thing. The other thing that the rainforest is very important for is it regulates the hydrological cycles throughout much of South America and into Central and North America even. And what I mean by that is the rain cycles. So the cycles of rain that are characteristic of that region and which are of paramount importance for many reasons, obviously climate related, but also economic reasons, you know, small farmers who need that cycle of rain in order to grow their crops and so on and so forth. The moment you start deforesting and getting rid of large chunks of the rainforest, the rain cycles change, and they change very dramatically. And we have evidence even that some of the droughts that have been experienced in parts of Latin America, including as far north as Central America, are directly related to rainforest deforestation or to deforestation of the Amazon.
Again, talking with Dr. Monica DeBoll, professor from Johns Hopkins University, specializing in Latin American studies, talking about the deforestation issue in the Amazon rainforest. And I wanted to get to this now, is basically, we have a new administration. What role do you think the Biden administration can take or should take? He did promise, you know, investing billions into this issue, but I mean, what is the world expecting of him right now?
Well, I think he has a potentially very large role to play in pressuring governments in the region, and in particular the Brazilian government, because that is the most rogue of them all in terms of dealing with environmental issues, into looking at the Amazon as a resource that the entire world depends upon. And it's not just about, as the administration, the Bolsonaro administration, has taken the stance saying, oh, it's our rainforest, it's our territory, we deal with it, we are sovereign, we're a sovereign nation. Well, the problem is that that's the incorrect view, because the rainforest affects the entire world.
Yeah, so what kind of pressure do you think that the U.S. and the world could put on Brazil?
A few. So on the one hand, there is room for partnership. So there is room for, say, engaging in financing and investment for sustainable activities in the Amazon. So there's a lot of development and a lot of cooperation and coordination that could be done that way, as long as the Bolsonaro administration agrees to following its own environmental laws. So that's one thing. So that would be sort of a type of carrot kind of policy. But there are also many sticks that can be used. And I think many countries, in particular European countries, have taken this line. They are not buying export products from producers in Brazil that do not have sustainable agricultural practices. And that, of course, is a type of a sanction. But these kinds of sanctions can be extremely useful in pressuring the private sector in a country like Brazil to itself pressure the existing administration into doing things that are protective of the Amazon and of the environment more generally.
Do you think it'll work, though? Because you think about the current president, Jair Bolsonaro, and he's proposed the smallest budget in 13 years for environmental protection. Do you think that that's enough to pressure him?
It's certainly not enough. So that's why I think you need a sort of a carrots and sticks approach. So you need, you know, on the one hand, countries putting pressure on their ability to just not buy certain Brazilian products. And of course, the Brazilian economy is currently in a crisis, as are many other economies around the globe. But at the same time, you know, there needs to be some sort of incentive, and that incentive coming from a financial source or from financial resources that can be directed to the Amazon could be very useful. But again, there needs to be a dialogue, and there needs to be at least a bit of a policy understanding as to the importance of the Amazon coming from the Bolsonaro administration. And I fear that, that's currently not there.
So I wanted to finish with this. There's this important angle to deforestation besides the climate change issue, which is very relevant now. It's the health threat. Research from Stanford University shows that a loss of forest can put people in contact with wild animals and viruses that they carry. How concerned are you for the potential for pathogens from the rainforest to spread the way COVID has? And what is the World Health Organization doing on that front?
Well, extremely concerned, because that's exactly the issue. I mean, where do these zoonotic or these viruses that can jump species, where do they come from? They come from their natural habitats, their natural hosts, which humans are coming more and more into contact with as they encroach on these habitats. And deforestation is precisely a way of encroaching on these habitats. The Amazon region already harbors a number of arboviruses. So, you know, the virus that causes malaria, the virus that causes dengue fever, the virus that causes Zika, the virus that causes chikungunya, you know, all of these which have been have come into contact with the human population recently. But apart from those, there are a bunch of other reservoirs of viruses that we don't even know of. And not having the right control over deforestation or an eye to public health related to environmental issues is extremely dangerous, because we could be setting ourselves down a path where we never recover from a pandemic, because we keep having recurrent ones from different viruses that we come into contact with.
Dr. Monica DeBole, again, professor of economics at Johns Hopkins University, with specialty is in Latin American studies. Again, talking about the deforestation issue with the Amazon rainforest. Again, more than just climate change, there's a lot that we lose if we lose that forest. Dr. DeBole, thank you so much. I really appreciate the insight.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, still to come, taking art out of the museum and into the public space, we explore Illuminate Coral Gables. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Have you been through Coral Gables recently? Maybe you went through recently and saw something that you usually don't see there. Well, that's because the city of Coral Gables is hosting a public art and light installation. It's called Illuminate Coral Gables, and it's on display until March 13th. Antonia Wright and Ruben Miadas are participating artists. They worked on a light installation, and Antonia joins us now. Antonia, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
Great to have you. Also, Patrick O'Connell, he's the co-founder of the exhibition. He's joining us now. Patrick, great to have you.
Thank you. A pleasure to be here.
Yeah. Anybody who's been through Coral Gables recently didn't know that there was a show, an exhibition, probably were surprised by some of the things they saw, but it's some really cool stuff. Patrick, for people who don't know, tell them what downtown Coral Gables now looks like. What will they expect to see?
Well, so Illuminate Coral Gables is a light-based fine art exhibition that is being presented in the public realm. And it consists of several large projection artworks covering some of the notable buildings in town, City Hall, the Miracle Theater, the Coral Gables Museum, and the Ocean Bank, also known as the Davidson Building on Lejeune Road. And then there are some sculptural works. Some of the most noted are certainly Antonia and Ruben's barricade installation, which I'm sure she will speak to a little bit further in a moment. But then we've also brought to South Florida for the first time an installation by a Chinese artist by the name of Zai Guichang, entitled Fireflies, which consists of pedicabs that are adorned with Chinese lanterns that roam through downtown Coral Gables during the evenings of the show.
Yeah, no, and I got to see that. That was really fascinating. Antonia, yeah, your work is titled Yes/No. These are these barricades covered in bright LED lights. When you walk around at night, they really stand out. What? Tell me a little bit about this exhibition. What is it you're trying to say with this?
Yeah, so I've collaborated with Rubén Liares on this project, and we've taken the city's barricades. We've covered them in LED lights, and there are four different locations around the city. You know, most people associate barricades with concerts or sporting events or things that are kind of fun, but we've really noticed them in protests. And barricades are designed to disappear into the landscape so that you don't notice them. And so by covering them lights, we aim to highlight them, pun intended, to really show their ubiquitous nature on our streets. They've really infiltrated our landscape without anyone really questioning them or noticing them. So we're hoping that people look at the world around them a little differently after the show.
Yeah, but part of the inspiration, right, was from the Black Lives Matter protest during the summer, because you had seen some of them.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, Ruben and I went to several of the protests, but we had been seeing them for a long time. I mean, Trayvon Martin was shot in Florida, and that was in 2012. And then you started seeing them, you know, and all the protests leading up. And then the Black Lives Matter protests happened this last summer when, you know, our country really erupted protesting racial injustice and police brutality. And it really kind of confirmed our idea.
What have you heard from people about, what have they said to you about the exhibit, about that part of the exhibit, I should say?
I think that it's like creating a situation where people are thinking about the streets differently. When they came to us, the curators, with the concept, we thought about the streets, that the show is on the streets, and we thought, you know, what's an object that symbolizes our streets today? And it's a range. I mean, because it's public art, it's so wonderful that it's so accessible. Like, I'm getting people are noticing it from all walks of life, not just, you know, my art friends who pay money to go to museums, you know, but everyone's seeing it. And I think that it's a really charged object. And by lighting it, we're presenting it in a different way. And they're really bright. They're incredibly bright.
Yeah. Patrick, where did the idea for Illuminate Coral Gables even start? Where did that come from?
So originally, the mayor of Coral Gables, Raul Valdez Fowley, going back to 2017, had an idea about doing a projection art show here in the city. And my co-founder, Benny Torrey, and I sort of took his idea. We gathered together a lot of the major stakeholder organizations here in the city. We formed a board, and we kind of brought the idea forward. The city was very interested in it, and they have been tremendous partners for us. And we really credit the city with helping us present this show. It's been about 2 years in the making to do it.
You know, and it's so interesting that, you know, this was way before the pandemic, you know, and so I'm wondering, like, you know, when the pandemic hit, and all of a sudden now we're forced to, well, at one point we had to stay inside, and, you know, we've been told since, all right, social distance, keep a distance. How did that force you to make adjustments, or did you have to? Because again, the unique part about this is it's already outside.
So we made a major pivot when, as a board, we decided to go forward with Illuminate Coral Gables back around May of last year. We were a few months into the quarantine. We were sort of scratching our heads about what, if anything, we were going to be able to do. And I credit our curatorial team, the Fung Collaboratives, with saying, why don't we pivot towards more projection? We originally had only had one or two projection works planned. And more sculptural work. But the sculptural work requires people to get close and stand around and gather in closer proximity. So we thought if we do more projection work, it would enable more people to view these works on a larger sort of canvas from a much broader area so people could spread out effectively. So We're presenting fewer works than originally planned, but at the same time, I think it's the right show for this particular moment in time.
Yeah. Antonia, what about you for your piece? Did the pandemic force you to adjust in any way?
It really didn't. Our work, these objects normally are on our streets outside. So for us, it was actually just, it's perfect. You know, it didn't change our idea anymore, but I think that it supported our idea.
Again, I'm talking with Antonia Wright. She worked on one of the sculptural light installations with artist Ruben Miyades. It's part of the Illuminate Coral Gables public art exhibit. We're also talking with Patrick O'Connell, co-founder of that exhibit. The works are created specifically to be outdoors. It includes, again, as we've heard, video projections, sculptures, and performative works. It's on display until March 13th, and you can find more information on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Patrick, one of the pieces is a moving performative work. It's the fireflies you mentioned earlier. I wanted to talk a bit more about that. This one, you said, this one's coming from a Chinese artist, right?
Yes. Yeah, so a Chinese artist by the name of Zai Guochang, who does reside here in the United States most of the time in New York, originally created this work with our curatorial team, with the Fung Collaboratives, about 4 years ago. It was originally created for the celebration of the bicentennial of Benjamin Franklin Parkway in Philadelphia. And the entire piece consists of 27 of these pedicabs adorned with Chinese lanterns. We originally intended to bring the entire work to Coral Gables and place passengers on them. So we would be riding people around downtown on the works of art. With COVID, this was another pivot we had to make for this particular year. We brought in a smaller number. We're typically showing 9 of them in the evening, and we are not taking passengers because of the complications with COVID and having people have to queue up and be close together and have riders ferrying people around. We just thought it was safer to wait until next year. We do have the Fireflies installation for 2022 as well, so we're excited to add passengers next year.
Yeah. You know, I mean, look, it's a public art display. So it's up there for everybody. It's not in a museum. It doesn't cost anything. Just show up. But of course, you know, people have to come to Coral Gables to see it. And Patrick, I'm just curious. I mean, look, Coral Gables is, you know, it's an affluent neighborhood. It's a very affluent part of the neighborhood. What are you doing to reach out to folks, say, in Alapata, Little Haiti, you know, Fort Lauderdale, to get them to come and see the work as well?
Well, thank you for that question, because really all along we have thought Illuminate Coral Gables was not really just for Coral Gables. This was something that was for the entire South Florida community and beyond, really. So certainly programs like this are getting our word out. We've had other media partners that have been great supporters of ours. We've also been careful, and our curator was very careful with the selection of artists so that we were inclusive of many different groups. We have two of the projection works are by a Caribbean artist by the name of David Gums, who put together a diptych of projection works. One is on the Miracle Theater. The other is on the building on Lejeune, the Ocean Bank Davidson building. And those have been major focal points of our show. One is entitled Echoes of Souls, which commemorates the loss of life from the pandemic and also from police brutality. And then Echoes of My Skin, which is an interactive piece which enables the patrons to actually move about in front of a camera and have their image projected into a part of the work on the wall of the Miracle Theater. Yeah. So we feel as if just the overall inclusiveness of our artist list is hopefully garnering attention from every community in South Florida.
But then beyond that, I mean, how else do you, you know, because one of the other things too, like a museum would do, is try to partner up with schools to get kids out there. Granted, a lot of the shows at night, is there any kind of partnership with Uber or Lyft to get people? In other words, I want to know, how do you get a kid from Little Haiti to say, I want to go check this out?
That's a great question too. You know, a big part of Illuminate was going to be a performative piece by Miami-Dade County Public School children. We did partner with Miami-Dade County Public Schools on a project by artist Carlos Estevez and we produced a video where Carlos instructs school-aged children how to create a kite. And then upon the kite, place an image of their face or something representing their identity. And with that, we had wanted to do a performative piece inviting children from throughout the districts to come to Coral Gables and do a parade of sorts with their kites. That's another piece of Illuminate that we'll probably need to save for 2022 just because of the idea of gathering that many people together.
Yeah.
So we've tried to reach out to the entire community through that educational effort. We have received some kites that may be on display this year, but we're not going to be able to do the performative part until next.
Yeah. You know, Antonia, I mean, talking about that, you know, access to art, that is one of the beauties of public art is that, again, anybody can go see it if they want to. And your piece, again, is very interesting in the fact that, you know, you were inspired by the social justice movement and the Black Lives Matter protests from last year. For you, I mean, you know, how do you think, you know, you could best reach out to as many communities as possible to get them to come and experience it?
I know that's a great question. Because it is on our streets, you know, our piece aims to highlight the democratic nature of our streets, that it is public space, you know, and the right to protest is being challenged. I am noticing that a lot of people are seeing the work that normally wouldn't see work in, you know, a museum setting because it is public. I get now like just so many different facets, like even my son's school, they wrote and sent out an announcement about Illuminate Coral Gables, not even knowing that I was in the show, just because it's such like a family friendly event for people to come to and walk around and socially distance, but still get to see art. So I think people are seeing it. I'm getting like so many people reaching out to me, like taking photos out of their car windows as they're driving by, like, this is your work. And people who have never, ever, ever noticed or been to a show of mine before. So it is a little trickier. I am on the board of Lotus House, which is a homeless shelter for women in Overtown. But just field trips and the nature of that right now could be a little, you know, dangerous. So hopefully for next year, we'll be able to really reach out to so many areas of the community. I think you're right. People should see the show. It's excellent.
Yeah. Patrick, there are some educational hands-on opportunities for this exhibit. People can get involved, right?
So I did mention the initiative with Miami-Dade County Public Schools, and we do have the instructional video that currently resides on our website, illuminatecoralgables.org. I mean, that is a major piece to this. We also have a coloring book that was created for one of the works by the artist Kiki Smith. And this is a piece that is hung above Giralda Plaza entitled Blue Night. And the artist lent some of her original drawings to create this coloring book that is a downloadable coloring book. And that is available on the City of Coral Gables website as well.
You just briefly, Patrick, you know, what kind of projects are you working on for the future?
Wow. So we are still in the midst of producing this year's show. We actually do have a meeting looking to next year later this afternoon to speak about the works that we'll be able to carry forward for next year, like Fireflies and like the Blue Night exhibit by Kiki Smith. And then to speak about what other works we're going to add in and how we're going to switch things up. So we do intend to have a second year and then move forward every year with Illuminate Coral Gables.
All right. So I caught you before the meeting. So I'll have to wait until after you're done with that. Antonia, let me finish with you on this. I'm just wondering how the pandemic is influencing you as an artist.
Wow. You know, I think artists are pretty adaptable and resourceful. It's not the same. Like, I used to have assistants who helped me in my studio, but now I'm making everything mostly on my own. And it's actually forced me a lot to apply for a lot of grants, you know, a lot of computery work, which is good. I won two big grants this year. So that's actually a great thing.
Great.
Thank you. Thank you. It's so exciting. So yeah, it's a good thing that's come out of this and kind of changed my working a little bit.
It's affected us all, hopefully for the better, but, you know, but that's great to hear. Again, I want to thank my guest, Patrick O'Connell, co-founder of the Illuminate Coral Gables Public Art Exhibition, and Antonia Wright. She's one of the participating artists. Learn more about their work on our social media at WLRN Sundial and how you can check it out. Again, it's up until March 13th. Patrick, Antonia, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Oh, this is such an honor. Thank you very much.
And that's our program for this Monday, February 22nd. Coming up tomorrow on the show, Mayor Francis Suarez has made the message loud and clear. Tech companies, investors, if you want, move to Miami. We're going to ask Mayor Suarez about his conversations with the Biden administration, with Elon Musk, and about Bitcoin. And by the way, if you have a question for him, send it to us now. Sundial at WLRNnews.org. Plus, Cuba is developing their own version of the vaccine, and they're not only making it available to tourists, they're advertising vaccine tourism. Would you go and do it? And finally, what are the aesthetics of excess? A new book explores the Chonga culture. That's all coming up tomorrow on the program. I'm Luis Hernandez. As always, thanks so much for listening. Stay safe, be good to each other, and we'll talk to you again live tomorrow.